what's working, what could be better, and what...
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting the Cy Anantum Devotional Ensemble on Sunday, April 13th at the Nimoy. Presented in partnership with the Hammer Museum, this evening of music, readings, and film is dedicated to the legacy of musician and spiritual leader Alice Coltrane, Turiya Sanghitananda. More information at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
This is Ed Begley Jr., and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Today's conversation follows our show 9 months ago, who described and analyzed the war in Sudan at that time. Since then, the civil war has escalated dramatically. The head of the UN Children's Agency, quoted in the UK Guardian, has said that the conflict in Sudan has created the world's largest humanitarian crisis. The war has killed tens of thousands of people, forced millions to flee their homes, and left some families eating grass in a desperate attempt to survive as famine sweeps parts of the country. I'm in conversation today with Asha El-Karib, PhD. She describes herself as someone who has been active in the democratic women's movement in Sudan since she was 18 years old. Asha trained as a rural economist and worked as a researcher, which helped her to become closer to the realities of rural women in conflict-torn country and has greatly influenced her activism. She's a co-founder and the current chair of the board of directors of the Sudanese Organization for Research and Development. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on my program.
Oh, the pleasure is mine, actually. I'm always looking for such opportunities. You know, we are trying to make our voices heard, especially we are looking for more solidarity among women and among feminists.
Tell us what you want feminists in the U.S. and the world to know about what's happening in Sudan right now.
What is happening in Sudan is not necessarily well known across the world. And it is very important for us to at least draw the attention, you know, of everyone, including or especially women, to know what is happening in Sudan. It is probably the ugliest, you know, and the most furious war that is happening between two yesterday's allies. You know, the RSF and the ASF were friends, you know, like less than 2 years ago. And now they are fighting each other. And the Sudanese people in general has nothing to do with this war. You know, it is happening in spite of them, and it is happening. And they are the ones who are really paying the price directly because people are dying. The two parties they don't care if they are killing civilians or they are killing people who are in their villages or whatever. And of course, there are other, you know, direct impacts of the war. You know, I can talk endlessly about what is happening in terms of not only the casualties and the deaths, but also in terms of the feminist, I'm more concerned, and this is what I'm doing about what is happening to the women of Sudan.
in case people don't know the history, you described the two warring parties as friends before.
Yeah.
What were they together about? And then what caused the split?
Actually, the RSF, which is the support forces, are militia forces, or let me say at that time, informal forces formed by al-Bashir, not only protecting the president and protecting the security, but also to guard, for example, the borders, you know. And they have been recognized, by the way, by the international community as well. And I have to say that even the EU has supported Hemeti, the head of this militia, to address the issues of the trafficking in Sudan and what they call the illegal immigration in Sudan. There was a big project called the Khartoum Process, supported by the EU at that time. And we in the civil society and as activists, we were very concerned about that. And we talked even to the EU about what they are doing, because they are creating a parallel power, you know, mm-hmm. to the army. And when during December Revolution and the transitional government, both the RSF and the ASF were in the Supreme Military Council. So they were working in harmony. They always praise each other. They applaud each other, you know. Mm. So they came to Khartoum. They claim very central and very important positions in Khartoum, including the presidential palace, that is till they together engineered the coup in 2021. So until the coup, they were together. They were friends, you know. And then after the coup, and when their government was not able to stabilize the situation and to ignore the popular resistance, you know, the differences started to show, you know. And then they started, they waged the war, you know, they started killing each other. And from this story, you can see that the Sudanese people have nothing to do with this, you know. If you dare, you know, in Sudan, if you dare to talk about the RSF, then you are the enemy. Immediately. If you dare to talk about the December Revolution, you are the enemy. If you dare to talk about the civilians who were heading the transitional government, you are the enemy, you know. And that is even confusing us, you know, because the same situation 2 years ago, you cannot say a negative word about the RSF. Yes. And that's why this war is very strange. And it is a war on the bodies of the Sudanese people. Who are not only impacted negatively by the war, like any other area of the world where there is war, but they themselves are now being polarized, you know. They are pulled by the two parties. So many militias are now being created, mainly on tribal basis, are supporting the RSF. So it is really very ugly. The situation is really, really very muddy. In the middle of this, the normal Sudanese people, the normal citizens are suffering, particularly women are very suffering. And what is happening to the women is something I cannot even describe, because the level of sexual abuse, the level of rape, the level of sexual exploitation, the level of forced marriages. You know, in Sudan now, a military guy, whether from RSF or from the ASF, he can just come and grab any woman or any girl and force her to marry him. Mm. Kidnapping, disappearance of women. Around now, 8 million Sudanese people are displaced inside Sudan.
Wow.
8 million. And 3 million outside Sudan, like myself. So 3 million were able to seek refuge in neighboring countries like Egypt, mainly Egypt, Chad, Uganda, Ethiopia, and so many also joined their siblings or their daughters or their sons all over the place, you know, in USA or Canada or Europe. So around 13 million are now displaced or refugees. Around 25 million in Sudan are now living on less than 1 meal a day. And the number of people who died because of the lack of medicines, the number of people who died because of the lack of basic health services is, and of hunger is really alarming. Of all that, you know that we do not have schools now for 3 years. This is something that will add to the militarization itself, you know, because especially boys and some girls who are not seeing themselves going to school anymore, sometimes they are manipulated to go and hold guns, you know, with the army or with the militias. So the circle or this cycle of militarization and weaponization is really, in my own analysis, is going to even hurt the country, even if the war stops. And we will go into like a vicious circle, you know.
There's really no such thing as post-conflict, is there? Especially
exactly.
In situations where you had two bodies, two forces that were friends, and then they split for their own political interests, right? Then people are forced to take sides. They have nothing to do with it, but are forced to take
exactly.
sides.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then all the violence, direct and indirect. You brought out yeah. something really important. Children, girls are being forced into marriage, and boys and girls are compelled to join the military. What a situation.
And to add the assault to the injury, a few weeks ago, the RSF and their allies, they started talking seriously, actually, and even producing a sort of like a draft constitution. They are very adamant to have a parallel government. And they call it the legal government in Sudan. So the possibility of imminent separation in Sudan is very likely.
Again.
Of course, Sudan is split before in 2011, you know
right.
that South
right.
Sudan. Yeah. And now, because most of the RSF and others are coming from the old areas of conflict, like Darfur and Nuba Mountains, those are the ones who are now joining hands, and they are talking about declaring this government very soon, although so many governments, including the UN and the African Union, did not welcome that idea. Mm-hmm. But they are going ahead, you know. And at the same time, Burhan on the other side in Port Sudan, because the capital is moved from Khartoum to Port Sudan, Khartoum is inhabitable now, you know. So Burhan in Port Sudan changed the constitutional document. He changed it to a more military dictatorship, you know, and he's assuming that he is the president of Sudan. And unfortunately, the international community, including the UN, are not objecting in a way. They call it the de facto government. But he is received worldwide as a president of Sudan. He talks to the UN. He talks to with the presidents and others, you know, like he is the real. When you talk to them, they say, okay, this is just a de facto situation and we have to deal with it. So this is just like a very quick glimpse of what is happening in Sudan. As we said earlier, like, for example, myself, because I at the beginning, when the war started, I was not planning to leave Sudan. I left Khartoum to my hometown. But then when my hometown was attacked, you know, and our neighborhoods were attacked, you know, we were under fire. We had to leave at that point. And I left, and I'm now a refugee in Uganda. I mean, after I had so many opportunities not to stay in Sudan in the past, but I refused, and it was not even in my mind to leave my country. Mm. But now I am living in Uganda.
Living in exile.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to wrap my head around all the points that you've made. Can you explain to us what is at the root of the conflict? If you dig below the surfaces, what are they fighting about?
Fighting around power and wealth, you know. When the RSF was formed, what do you call it, they were given a license to own mines of gold in Western Sudan. They were actually given the most prosperous area of Sudan. And Hemeti, the head, is absolutely has all the power, you know. to use that gold to sell it, to smuggle it, to do whatever he wants to do with it. And it's huge. And he was dealing mainly with United Arab Emirates, with Russia, with China, and with other areas of the world. But it was uncontrollable. It was not, the money does not come back to the treasury. That's why they were able to buy weapons, you know, and they were able to resource themselves. They are very resourceful. Okay. On the other side, increasing authority of RSF started to alarm the Congress party, the Bashir party, because they were thrown from power, and they were not expecting that big revolution. So they started to approach Burhan and to also promise him like all these promises, you know, power and wealth as well. So in my view, these are the two factors. They want to come back and control Sudan. But they are not doing that by themselves. And I always say that this is more like a proxy war. There are so many international actors. I think, in my own analysis, the revolution in December, which was an unbelievable revolution, you know, and the solidarity and the strength of the Sudanese people, ordinary Sudanese people, has frightened so many actors in the area. You know, and the main purpose of the revolution was, we want a civil state, we want democracy, justice, and peace. Mm-hmm. And there were so many signs that would happen in Sudan. So in my own analysis and so many others, that is a big threat to the world, because they use Sudan as what do you call, as a mine, you know, of gold.
And, literally a mine.
Exactly, a mine, you know. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, just imagine having a democratic civil state in the heart of Africa, mm-hmm. you know. Egypt would never allow that.
Correct.
It used to be a military led hegemony in Egypt, mm-hmm. and Sudan is the closest country to the south of Egypt. And they are also as well using these historical ties, you know, to continue using our resources, you know. So this, I think, idea has frightened everyone. So we want a stabilized military government in Sudan. I can talk about that forever, because I remember during the start of the December Revolution, before the outset of the regime, I was in Khartoum, and I remember having so many meetings with the European and ambassadors and others who were trying to convince us in the civil society and as women movement to agree with al-Bashir and to talk to him, and he's going to have an election, a free election, and so on. So they were very much trying, and they were very much frightened of, you know, of having a powerful critical mass, you know, of Sudanese people calling for democracy and multi-party system and human rights. And I think that is a big threat, you know, to the world, to the whole world, you know, who is now looking for Africa as their new colony.
In a sense, and, Sudan yes. was like the heartbeat exactly. of Africa, with all the resources and all the other outside interests want that.
Exactly.
Gold,
exactly.
agricultural products, you know, everything that they think is valuable. They don't want a democratic government. Right, because then the people have a say in how the resources will be extracted, or exactly. does that capture it?
Yeah, very much. You know, there will be more like accountability, a system, a law and order, and the people will be the ones who are controlling what is happening. And this is a very frightening idea, and it is now very clear, because now they are trying to kill, you know, to kill. Any memory of December Revolution, you know.
See, that's really, really, really dangerous step, yes. isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It is. And they are, you know, defaming the people, the leaders, and they are trying to portray, you know, the time before the revolution as the golden time, you know. So they said, you know, now this is happening because of the revolution, you know, and we had a stable government before the revolution, and we want to go back there. Mm-hmm. So it's all those actors, you know, the Muslim Brothers internationally were looking at the government of Sudan and al-Bashir as their model, you know. It was a model for an Islamic government. So they are now supporting, you know, they are supporting, even now during this war, they are supporting Burhan, you know, he's getting a lot of Iranian weapons. Qatar is supporting it. So because they still have this dream, you know, of Islamic governments coming back. I'm just now just trying to describe the situation. However, on the other side, Sudanese people are resisting. Just 12 days ago, there was a woman who is just trying to talk to other women about their safety and what to do together and why they are in this situation. And she's been shot immediately. So this is one factor.
Straight up terror, state security, state violence.
Exactly. And they are even sometimes make temporary laws, you know, because they say we are under emergency situation. Mm-hmm. So these temporary laws, and I will mention one of them. It is called the foreign faces. So they can just target you because of your face, you know, your features. You are not coming from this area. You are coming from Western Sudan. You look like Hemeti, for example. Your hair is not like us. So it is more like a very racialized, you know, behavior, you know. And this has caused so many people to go to jail, has caused so many people to be tortured. The other thing that they are using very widely, you know, is the social media.
We now return to my conversation with Sudanese feminist and human rights activist, Dr. Asha El-Karib. So, Asha, please continue.
So we are now trying to come together as women, feminist women, who are opposing militarization, opposing a war, not this war, opposing war generally, and opposing any idea or behavior or actual practice of militarization, and advocating for nonviolence, to come together and to try and make our voice heard, you know, in a more articulate way. I'm working on a feminist piece, and I'm trying very hard, and I have presented so many talks about feminist peace and what does it mean and why we should support the idea of feminist peace, among others. And this now is becoming like a conversation among women, you know. So many active women now are going to into that direction, you know, into the direction of let us have a strong movement, a real movement, not against this war, but against wars, you know. We are fed up with wars in Sudan. I mean, we are affected more seriously by military regimes and during al-Bashir time, it was very clear that it was a regime against women, you know. Mm-hmm. And that is maybe why some of the men now are not very clear, not very loud when they talk about opposing Burhan, like when they talk about opposing the RSF, you know, because during al-Bashir time, they really did not suffer the way women suffer, you know, from the military, Islamic laws and the Islamic regimes.
Right.
So I'm hopeful that we are also on the side. We are trying really to have a grounded feminist concepts. You know, we are trying to contextualize our feminism in Sudan. And my organization, the Sudanese Organization for Research and Development, is leading that in a way that we are now making consultations with women on the ground. We are talking to young women in particular, youth women who have experienced the December Revolution, but also the war period. We are collecting narratives and oral testimonies. We are trying to show how women are perceiving peace differently. And we are trying also to unpack the whole concept of intersectionality and to show that we don't need to be one group. We will never be one group, you know, or a homogeneous group, because we have different backgrounds, but we have to come to have common principles, you know, and common values. Yes. So this is what we are now trying. And I think the time is right, because in the past, there was an opposition, even from the women activists, to the concept of feminism, you know. It is very much rejected because people are saying that feminism is a Western idea and so on.
You exactly. hear so many places where women are struggling against yeah. militarism or, you know, for feminist ideas. Yes, so tired.
Exactly. What is happening, I think, I am hearing... even some of the women who were very loud against feminism in the past, they are now coming around. They say, okay, let us see what we mean by it. We need to know more about it and so on. So this is what we are now trying to do. We have organized so many workshops. As I say, so many seminars. We are doing a lot of writings now. And we are trying to widen the circle, you know, of feminist women with the... informed by our context, you know, and our experiences and so on.
How you understand yeah. feminism exactly. and feminist exactly. practices in context in this historic moment. The grassroots women, the elite women, do you see those two groups really making an effort to coming together to unify against militarism and for feminist principles? How do you see those two groups working together?
I think it is not yet there, but mm-hmm. I am seeing a process that will lead to that, you know, and I'm not seeing this theoretically speaking. Mm-hmm. Since the war, we have been doing consultations, direct consultations with Sudanese women on the ground. I think we have talked to more than 1,000 women, you know, at the grassroots level, like in depth.
Yeah,
because it shows very clearly to me that there was like a wall that is built between what is called the elite women and the grassroots level. And this is just like not a true wall, you know. The way it is, the women on the grassroots level talk about their experiences, they talk about peace, they talk about what they want in the future for them and for their children, in my view, is more articulate and more advanced than what some of the elite women that found themselves in the elite circle because of their tribes or because they found a chance for education or because of their political parties. I think, in my view, those grassroots level are more clear.
Talking clear. From their real lived experiences exactly. and maybe the exactly. elite women are talking more theoretically or... bias toward their party's interests, yeah, something
bias
like that.
Is there, you know? Mm. And that is why I think in the near future, by just recognizing that and recognizing the wealth of information and knowledge, this is our role, you know, how are those grassroots level are going to make their voice heard? It is through us, because they don't have the means and they don't have the time, actually. It is our responsibility to do it. We have to pay back.
At the transnational level, you know, how do women like myself and others in other countries, other contexts, who are working on this issue of anti-militarization, how do we, especially people from the U.S. like me, whose country is just fueling wars and supplying weapons everywhere, right? We have a very specific responsibility. It seems one of the big questions is how to work transnationally together and then distinguish the responsibilities of women from countries like the U.S. and Europe. What are our responsibilities given that our countries are a big source of the problem? So as you are building inside Sudan.
This is very important, because while we are working even at the grassroots level and trying to reach out for the women there and also trying to work with the same level, you know, like I cannot say that I'm not from the elite women, because I am, at the same time trying to connect, and not only to connect, actually to create a bond, you know, a real bond between us globally. For example, when we came to Uganda here, we found out that we are not necessarily very much connected to Africa, to the feminist movement in Africa. And there is a strong feminist movement in Africa as well, and globally, you know, Europe, US, and other places. I'm one who always try to show that, whether we like it or not, we as women of the world share not only dreams and aspirations, but we also share problems, you know. We share, we all live in a militarized world, we all live in a patriarchal world, we all are exposed to violence in different ways. So there is a lot that in common between us. We have to also affect the principle of equality. I always feel like there is sometimes power dynamics, you know, between us, and this has to be erased in a way or another. And that is will encourage us more not to give hope, you know. We have, for example, a partnership with a feminist organization in Canada. For me, it was the first time to learn about, for example, the Aboriginal women in Canada and what they are doing and their struggle. And this has given me more strength, you know, that we are not alone, that we are fighting and we are trying to find the ground, you know. So this sort of ties, you know, and bonds is very important to be strengthened and to continue.
I love that example you just shared with us, learning from experiences of women transnationally. I'm also thinking about intergenerationally learning together, creating knowledges together. I met a young Sudanese activist, Wayam, at the AWID conference. She was amazing. Can you talk a little bit about how you all are working together intergenerationally and why that matters?
We I'm Shoghi is one of the young feminists. We were together, you know, when she was much younger. We were trying to have like a feminist school, you know. Mm-hmm. That was much before the revolution. And more than 20 women came together, including Wayam, who was very young, and others. And I'm seeing them now, you know, very active. I also see my children, for example. They are free of so many of breaks, if you like, that hold us back. We were very much held by so many past, you know. We are carrying a lot of luggage, you know. Right. But our children are not, the young generation are not, they are more courageous, they are more very vocal. And I think giving our generation a credit, it's because we are now the parents, you know. Yeah. A few months ago, we held another workshop with 20 young feminists, and it was around their experience during the conflict. That was actually give us this idea of starting to write about our own feminism, you know, in Sudan, shaped by those experiences of those young women. That's why I'm hopeful. You know, they are very courageous. They are very vocal. They are ready to confront so many of the taboo issues, you know, the unspoken issue that we never talked to in the past. And the war itself, there is no positive side of the war, but there are some changes that will happen during the war, you know, and we have to tap on them, you know, because they are breaking so many of the conventional, you know, way that the Sudanese families used to hold as unbreakable, you know. And I don't want also Sudanese women to go back to where they were before the war, you know, because so many things happened, and we don't want to go again. And the experiences of other women, like the women in Liberia or the women in Eritrea who went back, you know, even in Rwanda now, the women are going back. So yeah. My hope is in those young feminists. And as you said, the intergenerational conversation has to continue. Just before the war, the young feminists said, okay, you have to sit and listen to us, and don't interrupt us. Let us say whatever we want to say. And I find that very promising.
I think that's a very, very hopeful note. And unfortunately, we're out of time. Asha El-Karib, you're one of the most courageous women I know.
I'm really, really very happy to have this conversation. Thank you so much.
Love. Love is a sacred word. Love is the name of God. The entire universe is created with love, by love, and in love. Love is the beginning. Love is the continuation. Love is the end.
Hi, this is Michelle Coltrane. Join me every Saturday at 4 a.m. for my new show, Awakenings. We will be taking a musical and spiritual journey into the world of Alice Coltrane and beyond. That's Awakenings every Saturday, 4 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
Let love supreme reign over the Shanti.
Hi, I'm Mimi Kennedy. As a longtime listener and supporter of KPFK and sometime guest, I don't think I've ever felt this station was needed more than it is now, in LA and across the globe. We in LA know KPFK has created community here, and it's up to us now to protect and sustain it. Think of where you get your news, your music, your connection. Phone and cable bills are through the roof, but for $5, $10, $20 a month, you can sustain this station and nourish this community. Go to kpfk.org/donate or call 818-985-5735 and press option 2. With 500 sustainers before the April fund drive, that drive will be shorter and KPFK will be stronger. kpfk.org/donate or 818-985-5735. And let's keep listening, let's keep supporting this station, and let's keep looking with hope towards a better time and a media that is truly free.
Support comes from CAP UCLA, presenting the Psi and Antum Devotional Ensemble on Sunday, April 13th at the Nimoy. Presented in partnership with the Hammer Museum, this evening of music, readings, and film is dedicated to the legacy of musician and spiritual leader Alice Coltrane, Turiya Sanghitananda. More information at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
After decades of restrictions to abortion across this country, people continue to find ways to make this vital procedure safer, more affordable, and more accessible. Remember what women have done in the past when abortion was illegal. And check in on today's movement facilitating abortions that are self-managed at home. We're not giving out medical or legal advice in this program. Instead, we're sharing an important history and new developments in abortion options. First, we bring you our adaptation of a piece by Hannah Nguyen and State of the Human. It's a look back at the Jane Collective of 1970s in Chicago, told by the Janes themselves. Officially known as the Abortion Counseling Service of Women's Liberation, these women offered safe, affordable, and friendly abortions when the practice was still illegal, and the alternatives were much more dangerous than today.
It was just like a powder keg. It was ready to go off.
We were so foolish that we weren't even afraid of getting caught.
I was 20 years old. I was really a kid. I was scared to death. We all were. We were all scared. None of us wanted to go to jail.
If we're at risk, we're all at risk.
May 3rd, 1972, in fact, the Chicago police from a precinct that we did not work in busted us. There were women screaming. There were women yelling. They asked us, "What are you in for?" And we said, "Abortion." And they said, "Ooh."
We'll hear arguments in number 18, Roe against Wade. In the absence of abortion or legal, medically safe abortions, women often resort to the illegal abortion. And in fact, if the woman is unable to get either a legal abortion or an illegal abortion in our state, she can do a self-abortion, which is certainly, perhaps, by far the most dangerous.
It isn't about population, it isn't about fetuses, it isn't about any of that stuff. It is really about controlling women.
I'm Judith Arcana. I'm a writer, a teacher, and of course, I'm a Jane. I got involved because in the summer of that year, 1970, I thought I was pregnant. I knew that at that time in my life, having a child would be terrible for the child and not good for me either. And so I thought, okay, I'll have to get an abortion. And one of the people that I thought of to ask was a medical student in Chicago. So I called him up. He said, everybody here says, call this number and ask for Jane. I called the number. A woman called me back. She said her name was Jane. Turns out, of course, it wasn't. Everybody said that. Soon I was one of the people saying that on the phone. As it happened, I was not pregnant. And so I called her back to say that I wouldn't need an abortion that time. And she said, we're taking in new people in the fall, and it sounds like you might be interested. Yes, as a matter of fact, I think I am.
I really felt that abortion rights were the front line of women's rights because women were literally were dying. Jean Gallitzer Levy, I'm 66 years old. When I was 20, I was a member of the Abortion Counseling Service. Women were dying from back alley abortions, but they were also dying because they were denied basic medical services that should have been available. Women would go to the hospital with natural miscarriage. And because there was such a stigma to abortion, they would be turned away. Women died of miscarriage during this period. We were a varied group. There were young housewives, people who were older, college students. Everybody coming into the service was trained as a counselor. And you would pick a woman, you would call her, you would set up a time for her to come over, give her a cup of tea, you know, like you would host anyone. And then we would explain what the procedure was. It was enormously empowering. What would happen, you know, this woman would come in, she had this terrible problem, which had the potential to make a complete mess of her life. You know, what she saw in front of her was disaster. And in 20 minutes, that was gone. That mess, that disaster that was sitting right here in her life was gone. And her life was in front of her. It was enormously empowering. And for many, many women in the service, it was the first time they'd really taken control of their lives. It just felt great.
Abortion Counseling Service was a context in which to put my ideas about how society should be. So yes, of course it was a politicizing situation, no two ways about it.
My name is Martha Scott. I live in Chicago and have lived here many, many years.
I was a counselor at the Abortion Counseling Service when I had my first abortion. And then much later on, I had an abortion again, and that was done by a woman I knew. Yeah. It should be just a normal possibility. It's not what you necessarily choose first. But if, in fact, it's what you need, it's what you need. When you see yourself as a person who is extended around a family, then if you do political work, then you see yourself as a person extended around a much larger entity. Or you're living in a way that maybe makes a difference to the world. That changes you. We were pretty ordinary people. Smart, competent, whatever, but pretty ordinary. And we did a very extraordinary thing. And we did this extraordinary thing because we had a goal and a vision and a group.
By the turn of the year was when we also began to learn medical practice.
Started to lean on our guy, teach us, teach us, teach us. And little things started to happen. He would let us come in to assist, which really meant in the beginning sit there beside the bed because it was in somebody's apartment. You know, there was no operating table. Sit down, hold her hand,
stroke her brow, give her some water to drink, whatever, you know, to be comforting. The first time I was allowed to come in blew my mind. It was constant. We did this every week, several days a week. Dozens of women came on those days for abortions. That's what had to get done. I was absolutely drawn to it. Like I said, I walked in, I saw it, I thought, whoa, this is the real deal. Look at this. And also, I think there was an element of learning to do and be competent at something that was important and valuable in women's lives. Of course, now we are practicing medicine without a license. Because, of course, when abortion is illegal, it's not medicine. Actually, what it is felony homicide, which is very scary. May 3rd, 1972, in fact, the Chicago police from a precinct that we did not work in busted us.
So I was working the front. I was sitting and talking to a woman who was very nervous. She had come with her sister. It turned out that she was the person who had turned us in. I really resent that. Later, I heard a knock at the door. So I went down the corridor and opened the door. And there were the two tallest men I'd ever seen in my life. And all I remember is seeing them. And then I turned around and I walked down the corridor in front of them without saying anything to them. I got into the room and I said, "These are the police. You do not have to say anything." They were furious and they arrested me.
If I thought I knew how the system worked, now I knew how the system worked. At this point, I'm 28 or 29 years old. I'm married. I have a tiny child. I've been arrested. My dad says, "You know, your mother had an abortion." And I was just blown away, not because she did, but because I said, "No, Dad, I didn't know that. Nobody ever mentioned that." And of course, I mean, if she had lived, and if she had been the mother who raised me, she may very well have talked to me about it. I'll never know. So my dad told me the story of my mother's abortion. I loved it. I mean, I don't wish unwanted pregnancy on anyone. Never in a million years would I. However, I loved the fact that this work that I was doing could have been. I can't believe I feel this. All these years later, but it still makes me choke. I could have been of use to my mother, my own mother, who was so young. Law and justice are not the same thing. There are many unjust laws. There always have been, there always will be. So I am not one who respects the law. The service was an enormous influence on my development as a human. And certainly, of course, as a woman.
Being a mother is really important to me. I wanted to be a mother, and I was, but I got to choose when, and I got to choose how. As a result, I was able to have the children I wanted and raise them the way I wanted to.
You, as someone who doesn't believe in this, have really no reason to tell me, who does feel it's appropriate, that I can't do it. You have your own choices. Those are legitimate choices. Good luck to you, should you be pregnant for the fourth time or tenth time and you don't want to have that baby. Your point of view does not impinge on, should not impinge on mine. And I'm not telling you to have an abortion, and you shouldn't be telling me not to.
I think that January 22nd, 1973 would be an historic day.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy...
We thought, well, this is a battle we've won. Well, of course, it's absolutely not true.
In this instance, the Supreme Court has withdrawn protection for the human rights of unborn children.
It's unbelievable. I would not have expected this. I thought we had gotten past it.
The House is moving forward with a plan to ban abortions after 20 weeks.
I would not have expected the assault that's going on women's health care. And we're looking at an assault on birth control, on basic preventative care, on health care for anybody who can't sort of circumvent repression.
You know, I've been participating in the March for Life for years, and there's one thing that had always struck me, and that is the vigor and the enthusiasm of the pro-life movement.
It isn't about population, it isn't about fetuses, it isn't about any of that stuff. It is really about controlling women. The fewer options women have, the less control they have. Women who have control are kind of threatening to the people who make these decisions, I guess. I mean, nobody wants to give up their power.
I don't see women sitting down and saying, okay, do what you want. I think women are going to be the backbone of the resistance. This is a generation of women who were consciously told they could do anything, they could have anything, they were human beings. And then in every kind of subtle and not so subtle undercurrent, they were told the opposite. I think we're sitting on another powder keg.
The Jane Collective performed approximately 11,000 abortions. They were arrested by the police one time in 1972. But their case was dismissed after the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court judgment made abortion legal throughout the United States on January 22, 1973. When people use phrases like on their own terms or outside of a clinic, they're referring to self-managing abortions. Unfortunately, most of the general public are not aware of the option of self-managed abortions. There are a variety of methods for self-managing, most of which are safe and reliable, often just using simple herbs or medicines. Many advocates say the focus needs to be on decriminalizing those options for all people, whether there's a clinic accessible or not.
People will end their abortions outside of clinics, and helping them do so safely or as safely as possible is part of the way that providers think about what they're doing. So self-induced abortion is explicitly illegal in Arizona and six other states: Delaware, Idaho, Nevada, New York, Oklahoma, and South Carolina.
So those are the states where self-managed abortion is explicitly illegal. But people have been arrested in other states where conservative prosecutors can charge people with the unlawful practice of medicine or use so-called feticide laws to prosecute people who have or assist with self-managed abortions.
So even if there's a state that doesn't explicitly ban self-induced abortion, because prosecutors have their own personal beliefs about abortion, they're increasingly using things that might not seem like they connect as charges to prosecute people. But there are many different ways that prosecutors can and have investigated and brought charges against and incarcerated people for self-induced abortion. This great organization in the Bay Area called the SIA Legal Team has identified 40 different types of laws that could be used to prosecute someone for self-induced abortion or for helping someone end their own pregnancy. They really vary. So there's procuring a miscarriage, which sounds very arcane, but is still illegal in some places. People have been investigated and prosecuted for failing to report a death to the coroner, for misusing fetal remains. Prosecutors sort of throw charges at the wall to see what sticks, like pasta. Over the last 8 years since the 2010 midterms, there have been sort of a record number of anti-abortion legislation passed across the country. Hundreds of laws have been introduced and many of them passed, and they've really run the gamut in the ways in which they restrict abortion. But, you know, they either limit when you can get an abortion, or they make it harder for providers of abortion to do their jobs by requiring that they, you know, have hallways a certain width, or that they meet with their clients or patients several times before offering the abortion. Trump's election sort of solidified this idea that access to abortion in clinics was sort of had reached its peak and was going to decrease. Access would decrease going forward. And one of the promises that Trump made during his campaign was that he would actually overturn Roe v. Wade and would basically make getting abortions illegal. So what does abortion look like when it's no longer legal, and also when it's effectively not legal and available because of these restrictions?
If abortion becomes illegal, more people will probably turn to in-home abortions. Fortunately, self-managed methods have improved greatly over the past decades. And now, as in the past, there's a growing movement of brave folks building a network to share knowledge and support.
When we look at the underground abortion movement on a worldwide level, what we see is women rising to the needs of anyone that desires reproductive freedom. When you have a pregnancy and you cannot handle that and you need to terminate it, you need to be able to do that. The reason that right now there's more action is because people don't trust the state. We have so much legislation. What we just saw in Texas with the closure of abortion centers, we see an onslaught of hatred and anti-abortion legislation that has been exceedingly positive for them. We are not winning. The reason women are gathering is because we've been losing ground. I think it's very important as a feminist revolutionary that we recognize that we are living in fascist times, and that it has always been so that we have been under control as women, or trying to be under control. But I have to say that we live in one nation under surveillance, and that it's very important that we proceed carefully, cautiously, and recognize that we must step forward. This is not the time for passivity. The earth depends on us taking action and making a stand. If you're sitting on the fence right now, you really just have a stick up your You've got to make a decision and take a step. And learning about your body and taking responsibility for yourself, for your reproductive health, that is revolutionary. So welcome to the team, because the world needs you. And we need knowledge to be shared, not controlled.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
I'm Andrew Tonkovich of Bibliocracy, KPFK's weekly books show, Thursday at 2:30. My guest this week, Andrew Nichols, has written a story in verse about the doomed filming of Werner Herzog's Fitzcarraldo. Here's the author reading a stanza. I dare you not to tune in to hear more.
Herzog, of filmic auteurs the Achilleist, found where the Amazon basin was. Helleist built his own Troy, provisioned it, fenced it, donned armor, then went off to battle against it. For he had decided la métaphore juste, for the struggle of art, the mind's arrow unloosed, was a muse-sotted esthete, a tune-loving pill dragging a steamship up over a hill.
Thursday at 2:30 on Bibliocracy.